The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now we continue on with our discussion and evaluation, but now finally deal with freedom in cosmical interrelatedness. In view of what I have said, we conclude then that human freedom will always be freedom under law. Indeed, this law, or this order, establishes the limits of freedom that might suggest what we think of as a limitation, somehow something that is negative, but I do not mean it in that way. I've already said, Julie, that this kind of limitation of which I'm speaking is intrinsic to freedom under law, that the only kind of freedom that we shall admit is a freedom under law, that is, an ordered freedom, a freedom that is within the cosmos as it has been ordered by God. And such a freedom, then, is intrinsically limited, but nevertheless, as I've also suggested, this limitation, the order in which this freedom then occurs, even in which then it is augmented, in which we come to the awareness that brings us freedom, that this depends upon the order, and that this order not only limits but founds the possibility of freedom. And, as we have seen throughout the entire course, the way this law is conceived, the way the order in the creation is conceived, will basically affect the way freedom is conceived. You cannot, as you might, one might very well conclude then, that it is impossible to have any view of freedom without a view of order. And that is actually what we've been saying, that if you're going to have a true view of freedom, you have to have a true view of order, which is given to us by the revelation of God. Now, to delineate then the nature of freedom in various areas, one will have to analyze the structure of law as it is given in the created cosmos. In the Calvinistic philosophy to which I have been referring, and as should be already evident, I refer then to the group of thinkers, namely Cornelius Van Til, who taught for so many years at Westminster Seminary, and then Herman Dooyeweerd of the Free University of Amsterdam, and D.H.T.H. Vollenhoven, also of the Free University, and then Hendrik Stoker, H.G. Stoker, who taught in Potchefstroom, South Africa. Well, in their analyses, one more, one less, they spoke then of the order that God has given in the creation, distinguishing, for example, certain modal aspects, an order of modal aspects with their founding and anticipating functions. I've already spoken to some degree of modal aspects. And then in the second place, individuality structures. I've already spoken of those. And we have in mind, at this juncture, these individuality structures, especially as they pertain to social life. And then we have to speak then of the opening process, or as the process of which is involved with historical development, as these are opened up in their structure and with the with increasing freedom manifesting in increasing freedom. And they also speak of a structure of man which bears on his earthly, on what Doibert calls in a way, his temporal existence. And I've already spoken of that too, as I have spoken about the relationship of philosophical anthropology to the question of human freedom. But there are particular angles here from which we have not yet approached these questions. In regard, for example, to the modal aspects, the intercosmical relatedness as we see it in the modal aspects. Now, as I have said, the Calvinistic philosophy has developed the theory that individual persons, things, events have various sides or aspects which may be distinguished from one another in theoretical analysis. Most recently, this philosophy distinguished 15 aspects, which ranged then from the arithmetical or the arithmetic aspect at the lower end of the scale to the pistical aspect or the aspect of faith at the top of the scale. In speaking of lower and higher here, one does not speak of less important and more important, but rather simply that as one writes them down, one starts at the top of the page with the pistical or faith and goes down to the bottom in arithmetical. And furthermore, that the lower ones, so-called, then are foundational to the higher ones, but not indicating any, as I have said, indicating any ontological priority of the one over the other, because they are all created aspects, and that they all then are placed there by God, and there's no ontological priority of the one over the other. But they appear in an order, the lower founding the higher, the lower ones able to anticipate the higher, and the higher ones looking back, as it were, retrospecting, as it is called, retrospecting the lower. But in looking upward, you might say, that there is the possibility of the lower aspects being opened up by the higher ones. I have, in effect, been dealing with this process already in speaking of the deepening of the awareness of the Christian in faith, because one has awareness, but this awareness is deepened as he then responds to God in faith. There is a deepening process that enters the Christian's life, let's say, in obedience to what God has said, in a life of obedience that opens up as his life is opened up in through faith. And it is possible then to analyze such things in a theoretical fashion by in terms of such a modal scheme. A modal analysis then helps in understanding, from a theoretical point of view, what we have already been talking about. Now, if one is interested in a more elaborate discussion of these modal aspects, one may indeed turn to that introduction to Dooyeweerd's philosophy by L. Kalsbeek, capital K-A-L-S-B-E-E-K, Contours of a Christian Philosophy, published in Toronto, Ontario by Wedge Publishing Company in 1975. Translation of the original Dutch De Wijsbeerte de Westede, or the philosophy of the cosmonomic idea, Proeve van een Christelijke Philosophie, or an attempt then to establish or erect a Christian philosophy. And this was published in Amsterdam by Buiten en Schipperheim in 1970. This is acknowledged as one of the better, really at the moment the best, general introduction to this philosophy. And it has then a rather extensive description of the various modal aspects, this modal scale of which I am speaking. But the thing that I have particularly in mind at the moment is this, that in the opening process, higher aspects are no longer bound rigidly to those which go before. There is a freedom that is introduced into the cosmos. There is a freedom which is involved here in an opening process. I would like to give one illustration. I believe it's a very important illustration of this in regard to one of the aspects, namely the psychical aspect. It is was called for many years the feeling aspect. Later on, Dooyeweerd returned to an older term, namely sensitive. He calls it the sensitive aspect, the psychical aspect. This then is in the scale. You have the arithmetical, you have the spatial, you have the kinematic or the aspect of motion, you have the physical, the aspect of energetic effect, you have the biotical aspect, which is the aspect of life, but then you have the psychical aspect, the aspect of the sensitive, and you have that then clearly in animal life. Man is a sensitive being also, but he then has this side to him that he is a sensitive creature. But now it is possible then for this aspect to be opened up. One can speak, for example, of ethical sensibility, ethical feeling. And in accordance with this viewpoint, looked at from the standpoint of the psychical is opened up in ethical sensibility. Well, we do find other illustrations of this so, too. Aesthetic sensibility. An opening up of the faith in aesthetic appreciation, that one then can gain in his awareness, that one then can find his awareness deepened in an aesthetic way. But the aesthetic then is not separate from, is not just divorced, let's say, from feeling. It is not divorced from the sensible or the sensitivity, but there is an aesthetic sensibility, an opening up of sensibility, a deepening of sensibility, even as there is an ethical sensibility. One can speak of pistical sensitivity or sensibility. One can speak in this, in faith, of the sense of the presence of God when one is engaged in worship. Then one is sometimes confronted with the question, with the problem of the relationship of his worship to feeling. Well, if one looks at it in this point of view, he will not then separate out worship, let us say, from feeling, but he will realize that it is feeling in this opened, as it is opened up in faith, that there is a sense of the presence of God, and that the worship then must then not only reflect this presence, but must be conformable to this presence, that one does not then do something in worship which is contrary to this sense of the presence of God. Now, Calvin, John Calvin, and others have spoken of a sensus communis, of a common consciousness, sometimes as it's called, a common sense, a sensus communis. A sensibility, a sensitivity of a communal kind. A sensitivity that is weakened but not obliterated by the fall. It seems to me when they've talked in this way, they have not had in mind a feeling of a kind simply that one has when he touches, let's say, a physical object, as I might touch the table on which my binder is resting, or a feeling of the kind when one feels tired, and so on. But a deepened sensibility. And so that in mankind, there is a sense, a feeling, a common feeling that certain things are right, let's say, and certain things are wrong. In common, God's common grace, these sensibilities have been preserved. They have not been completely obliterated by the fall. And so that there is even among the Gentiles, even among the nations, even among those who are not of the household of faith, the scripture tells us, there is still the understanding that there is a sensibility so that men do by nature the things that are written in the law. One may speak of a sensus deitatis, as we do, or of the sense of deity. This has a side, then, which is a deepened awareness. The irrational philosophy of religion of a Rudolf Otto, Rudolf, capital R-U-D-O-L-F, and Otto, capital O-T-T-O. In this irrational philosophy, there is talk of the numinous, N-U-M-I-N-O-U-S. Now, without accepting Otto's irrationalism, or giving the same place he did to this numinous experience of what he called the tremendous, overwhelming mystery, a fascinating mystery, the mysterium tremendum et fascinosum, we may still observe that Otto is pointing to something that has a real place in our experience, a sense of what is awe-inspiring and fascinating that lies in back of and suffuses our ordinary experience in the world. We're opened up in faith to see, for example, that God then has brought all this into being. And in our faith, there is a deepened sensibility that our emotions then are exalted and they well up in us in response to our experience of the presence of God in His creation. We might say that certain lines in the well-known song Home on the Range are not merely sentimental. They're not simply expressions of sentimentality, but do reflect such a deepened sensibility. Now, in terms of our Christian understanding in these ways, based on an integral Christian worldview, we are able to avoid a rationalistic position which sees sentiment, a feeling rather, as mere sentiment, which then seeks to preserve, let's say, a quote-unquote manly or quote-unquote intellectual attitude. Some people, in a rationalistic attempt, seek to suppress feeling. Some people, strangely, want to eliminate all feeling from worship. They think somehow it is of no importance or gets in the way, is disturbing, or whatever it is. I detect in such attitudes a latent rationalism. It is impossible to repress feeling completely. If one tries to do so, then feelings come out in a very explosive way. It seems to me, on the contrary, that we are freed in our understandings if we know that feelings can be educated. They are indeed deepened, they are educated, that there is deepened, educated emotion, and that our feelings, our emotions are deepened, they are educated, for when as they are led by faith. I've observed this already. And so that when we come into the house of God in worship, as we believe in Him, there are these exalted sensibilities, exalted feelings, which are quite in place and which are expressed then in the fervency with which one sings, in which one recites the creed, or whatever it is, not then the wildfire of unbridled emotion, unschooled emotion, but a true emotion, an emotion that is geared to the situation of the true worship of the living and true God. Now, one can then approach such notions, and many others also, in terms of a modal analysis, such as the so-called Calvinistic philosophy has undertaken, and so that we can see the place of feeling, of emotion, to just give one example here, in the response of the Christian, and avoid such views as a rationalistic position, which then, as it were, wants to leave feelings to one side to give them only a much lesser, much more secondary position, or perhaps even no position at all, and which then feelings are left in their so-called, not in their open, but in a closed position, in which then there is a danger. I should say almost the inevitability then of their appearing in an explosive fashion, because they have not been schooled. There's no idea that they are integrally taken up into our life, into the response that we find. Now, if we have then looked at the modal scale very briefly and tried then to indicate some of its meaning within, as it has meaning for our lives as Christians, Then we also look at the sphere sovereignty idea again. But as that has been expressed in the description of the various spheres of life. Now, what I'm going to do at this point is simply take the booklet that I have written, namely Sociology, with the psychology booklet material that I have been using in my course, The Encounter of Christianity with Secular Science, and I'm going to quote from it the material that I have on these various terrains of life. This booklet was copyrighted and published in 1981, again by the Christian Studies Center of Memphis, Tennessee. If one wants further discussions along this line, he can look at Carlsbeck's book, or he can look at Dooyeweerd's New Critique of Theoretical Thought. He can look at other writings. But let me then begin here, first of all, with what I have said about the family. And I quote, "The family, in the narrow sense of parents and their siblings, has a definite individuality structure, with its own founding function and its own pilot function. In this restricted sense, the family is biotically founded in the sexual union of man and wife and the natural begetting of offspring. Its founding function stands in unbreakable connection with its pilot function, the ethical communion of love between husband and wife and their children. As an individuality, the family can be defined only if one takes into account both what founds it and what leads it. It is an enduring communion of love between husband and wife on the foundation of the biotic union of the sexes and the natural begetting of offspring together with these children themselves. The founding function and the pilot function of the family, we must emphasize, cannot be isolated from each other. The communion of love between husband and wife cannot be dissociated from their sexual union. Nor should their sexual union be abstracted from their mutual love. In married life, the communion of love and sexual union are always interacting, either stimulating or deflating and weakening each other. The concrete method of concept formation, characteristic of the theory of sphere sovereignty, is very apparent in the foregoing view of human sexuality. It does not consider man's sexual life abstractly, simply as a natural inclination without any inherent limits. Neither does it harbor a so-called spiritualistic view of sexual life, as if for a Christian it were something that must be tolerated within the marriage bond, but that has nothing essential to contribute to the quote-unquote higher, quote-unquote spiritual side of marriage. The scriptures do not support such a spiritualistic view any more than they support a naturalistic view of human sexuality. A Christian sociologist should give due place to sexuality within the marriage bond, indeed within man's entire makeup. Nevertheless, he should not isolate it. He should resist the widespread, nearly universal inclination to view human sexuality abstractly as a natural drive requiring and deserving satisfaction, one that has no inherent limits. In this view, marriage is regarded as a convenient arrangement for the mutual satisfaction of the sexual drives of the marriage partners. Human sexuality, however, may not be isolated in this fashion. Indeed, it cannot. Such an attempt is a futile effort to tear sexuality out of an entire fabric of relationships. This effort must certainly fail. Within the framework of such an abstract view of human sexuality, there is sometimes a romantic divinization of the sexual urge. This is clearly represented in contemporary life and literature. In most cases, however, the glow of eroticism has given way to regarding a member of the opposite sex as one to be exploited for one's own carnal satisfaction. Often, love is dismissed as excess baggage for one who would preserve his own autonomy. One should not endanger his self-sufficiency by becoming emotionally involved. Human sexuality is structured, however, even though it is not bound to the instinctual patterns of the animal. That is true of it across the board. It is an error to think of human sexual desire simply as a blind drive. It is unfortunate to think of the male as naturally polygamous and of the female as naturally monogamous. Indeed, there is no automatic limitation to the scope of sexual impulse. Nevertheless, sex can come to its rights only if it is kept within its divinely ordained bounds. Sexual cohabitation occurs rightfully only within the marriage bond. Apart from marriage, it is degrading and destructive. Those who throw over the traces and practice free love do not discover true freedom beyond the onerous restrictions of convention. They invite personal decay, and they help to demoralize the society around them. The individuality structure of the family is manifest profoundly in the specific relationships of authority and subordination that pertain within it. According to the scriptures, the man is the head of the woman, 1 Corinthians 11:3, Ephesians 5:23. The woman is admonished to render due obedience to her husband, 1 Peter 3, verses 1 and 5. Parents have authority over their children, and the children are commanded to obey their parents in the Lord, Ephesians 6:1, Colossians 3:20. The specific relationships of authority and subordination within the family, however, should be led by the pilot function, the communion of love. The authority of a husband is not unlimited. It is not indeterminate. It has a special character. A husband is commanded to cherish his wife as he does his own body, Ephesians 5:25, to love her as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it, Ephesians 5:25. Furthermore, fathers are admonished not to discourage their children, Ephesians 6:4. That the family has an authority structure peculiarly its own is observed, for example, in the fact that the responsibilities of a father to his children are different from those of the same father to the children of another. Should he attempt to approach another's children in the same way he approaches his own, he will quickly discover that he obtains a different response. The tact with which one must approach situations in family groups other than his own is far more than a matter of social courtesy. It is rooted in the specific individuality of the family unit with its unique relationships of authority and subordination. The individuality structure of the family, qualified as it is by its pilot and its founding functions, impresses a special cachet on all of the relationships within it. The love among members of a family is not the same as the love expressed to persons outside the family circle. Love within the family itself, moreover, may not be regarded abstractly. Love within the family is indeed love. Nevertheless, each of the various love relationships within the family, the love of a wife for her husband, the love of a father for his child, etc., has a nuance of its own, which may not be lost to sight by the Christian theorist. There are also legal relationships within the family. These must be distinguished from the purely legal relationships the family sustains to individual and groups on the outside. The family, too, has internal economic relationships and problems. A family, however, is not a legally or economically qualified unit. The legal, economic, and other relationships within its circle never play themselves out in isolation from its individuality structure. There is even a correlation between the financial soundness of a family and the sexual relationships of husband and wife. And now we turn for a moment to the state. The state, too, has its own structure of individuality and its own corresponding sphere of competency. Unlike the family, however, the state is not a natural community. It is historically founded, a result of man's free-forming activity. The leading function of the state is a juridical one. The state has the exclusive power of the sword over a particular territory by reason of a duly constituted authority. The state possesses a sovereignty that cannot be derived from that of any other group. It is not an extension of the family. It is not subject to the church, not even with regard to matters that are supposed to pertain to the eternal blessedness of the soul. Indeed, in a society that is yet undifferentiated, there is no clear distinction between the cultic, the state, and the family. Think, for instance, how family, state, and cult merged in the patriarchal family as it existed in the time of Abraham. It is only in the course of history that they were differentiated. An idea widely held in Christian circles is that the state was instituted because of sin. Certainly, the coercion accompanying the activities of the state is a result of sin. In the course of historical differentiation, however, some kind of central authority with some functions resembling those of the modern state would most likely have arisen even apart from sin. Sovereign in its own sphere, the state has a direct responsibility to God. Within its own sphere of jurisdiction, it must seek to carry out the divine will. It has a responsibility given it by God to administer justice within its bounds. It must root out injustice and prevent civil disorder. The foundation of the authority of the state may not be sought, therefore, in the will of the people, let us say in the volonté générale, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Failure to strive for justice, even when the cause of justice has little popular backing, will lead to unrest and strife, just those social evils that the state should seek to avoid. Associating the state with the divine will has often been thought to free it from all limitations. It is supposed to sanction any and every expression of its sovereign will. It gives to the state unrestricted power and authority, so its detractors claim. Such unlimited authority was given the state by the Roman imperium idea. It was carried on in the idea of the divine right of kings. Absolute sovereignty, however, belongs only to God. The sovereignty of the state, on the contrary, is a derived one, just like that of any other sphere. The authority of the state is intrinsically limited. The state is not a state leviathan. It has its own unique sphere of competency whose bounds it may not transgress. Just as God's universal calling is channeled in individual directions, so his sovereign will is expressed individually for the various spheres. Those with authority in the state have the calling to carry out the divine will in accordance with the individuality structure of the state. Might one not argue that it is impossible to discover an intrinsic limitation to the power of the state? Does not the state have the exclusive right of the sword within its own territory? Is there any power that can withstand it? Attempts of the state to go beyond its proper limits, however, always lead to disruption. There are some things, in addition, to which the authority of the state cannot extend, try as it will. A limit has appeared, for example, every time the state has attempted to uproot and abolish the family. Needless to say, it has always failed. If one attempts to define the nature of the state analytically, thinking of it, for instance, as one way, among others, of organizing man's psychical needs, he cannot understand its inner bounds and intrinsic responsibilities. A definition of the state must rest upon a conception of its bounds, and this must rest upon an understanding of its structure. A Christian sociologist must ferret out the state's individuality, structure. And then the industrial unit. And again, I quote, "In a developed culture, there is an inevitable rise of industry and the industrial unit. Invention is an accompaniment of historical progress. Even in a relatively primitive stage of cultural development, there is a use of utensils and tools. These, of course, must be fabricated. Gradually, there is a sophistication of cultural artifacts with increasing division of labor in their fabrication and diversification in their use. In modern times, this development progressed far enough that we are now living in what we may call an industrial society. The production, distribution, and consumption of goods with all their complexities has molded our age profoundly. Like the state, the industrial unit is historically founded. It has its pilot function, however, in the economic aspect. It is qualified economically as to its individuality structure. The test of the success or failure of an industrial unit is a typically economic one. Relationships within an industrial unit will be patterned according to its unique individuality structure. This we may illustrate by contrasting the economically qualified relationships within the industrial unit with the economic relationships within the family. Within a family, for pedagogical reasons, there may be a certain arbitrariness with respect to economic matters. A father might not reward his children in every instance exactly alike. He might not present each of them with a gift of equal worth. He might not always reward them equally for chores they have performed around the house. Within the family, this approach might be a loving stratagem to teach one's children contentment with what they have. In the providence of God, they will not always obtain what they deserve, nor will they always be rewarded equally. To teach a profound truth of faith, Christ spoke the parable of the workmen, each of whom was given a penny for working in the vineyard, irrespective of the time he had labored." Matthew 20, verses 1 through 16. Within the industrial unit, on the contrary, there must be a strict economic quid pro quo. Failure to observe this requirement transforms an economic unit into something else. It also affects the dignity and the freedom of the working force. The dangers of failing to take the specific individuality of the economic unit into consideration is illustrated by the following true story. A young woman was employed by a business concern as a secretary. Since she was recently engaged to be married, she was eager to leave the office promptly at closing time in order to be with her fiancé. The other girls at the office, hoping to gain preferment, were in the habit of remaining after hours, putting in overtime without additional compensation. As a result, the engaged girl was faced with a dilemma. If she exercised her right to go home at closing time, she was resented by her co-workers. If she remained at the office, she was robbed of her freedom to be with her fiancé. Because there was no strict economic quid pro quo, office morale was weakened and employee rights were curtailed. In such a case, a business ceases to be an economically qualified unit. Its character has changed. It now resembles a free social grouping where the members are bound together by moral compulsion. This kind of compulsion has an important place, of course, in a family industrial unit. Within a family industry, more than economic considerations play a major role, with a corresponding likelihood that problems of a non-economic nature will fundamentally influence production. We now turn to the church. The church as an institution is also historically founded. This fact may help to account for the perplexity of those who understand social life naturalistic, let us say in terms of man's psychical or biotical needs. They discover that they cannot find a place for the church in this way. The legitimation of the church cannot be understood apart from the historical events connected with its founding and apart from the commands of Christ which established its nature. The church as an institution has been entrusted with the proclamation of the word revelation of God, with the administration of the sacraments, and with the exercise of discipline over its members. These tasks belong specifically to the church as an institution. Everything that the church does should be structured in terms of the commission that God has given to it. All of its internal and external relationships will be colored by its pilot function. The church, as well as the family, the state, and the industrial unit, has a great variety of internal relationships. Among others, there are relationships of a social, legal, and economic kind. These, however, do not pilot the activities of the church. To be specific, the church has internal economic relations. It collects and disperses funds. It must seek to establish efficient working relationships between its various parts. Nevertheless, the church per se is not an economic unit. Its appeals for funds and its attempts to obtain efficiency in its operations should be guided by its leading function. The specific individuality of the church is manifest in its exercise of authority. It, like the state, must exercise discipline. Unless its influence is such that it can bring social sanctions to bear upon its members, however, it soon discovers that its exercise of discipline differs markedly from that of other social groups, and especially from that of the state. I might say parenthetically that there is no idea here that the church should seek to bring social sanctions to bear upon its members. This is only offered in order to elucidate that of which we are speaking. But to resume the quote, it soon discovers that its exercise of discipline differs markedly from that of other social groups, and especially from that of the state. Frequently, one who is brought under ecclesiastical discipline will simply withdraw himself from the fellowship. His action is reprehensible. He resists thereby the God-given authority of the church and mocks the vows he has made. Nevertheless, he places himself effectively out of reach. Such a case illustrates the matter-of-fact, that is, material limitations of ecclesiastical authority. Unlike the state, the church does not possess the power of the sword over a particular territory, nor should it seek this power. Its methods should be those of spiritual persuasion, with a readiness again to receive the erring sinner when by divine providence he is brought to repentance. One must also keep the specific individuality of the church in mind when dealing with its external relationships. The kingdom of Christ is broader than the church as an institution. The church exists next to other institutions. Each of them has the responsibility, just as the church, to give expression to the kingship of Christ. In the interests of the kingdom, the church should retain its own identity, but also encourage kingdom work in other areas, such as Christian social action and Christian politics. The specific individuality of the church should especially be kept in mind in the face of the growing opinion that the gospel is politics. At the least, this view must rest on the idea that the preaching of the gospel leads directly to political consequences. One of its blandest forms is that gospel witness produces a society, the church, that acts as an alternative to worldly societies. At its extreme, it has appeared in the political theologies of revolution, which have been substantially influenced by Marxism. A revolutionary political tendency was already present, however, in the sectarian movements at the time of the Reformation. In contrast, especially with the Calvinistic Reformation, they attempted to set up a Christian society beside the society of, quote, unquote, the world, and separate from it. Such a society is sometimes viewed as a revolutionary challenge to existing society. In a milder fashion, it is sometimes thought of as a model for society. A common tendency is to accord political significance to the preaching of the gospel. Preaching the gospel leads to the formation of the supernatural community in separation from and as a challenge to the socio-political institutions of, quote, unquote, the world. Thus, gospel preaching leads directly to political consequences. The sectarian position rests upon a simple, abstract disjunction between the church as the scriptural community and the world. It abandons the scriptural teaching, understood most clearly by Calvin, that the created order of reality, though seriously affected by sin, has not been abolished and is being sustained by God's common grace. It forgets that there is an imperative, according to God's call, to serve also in spheres other than that of the institutional church. Conversely, the church is not an alternative society, but is a particular sphere of life with its own nature and its own calling. Let the church be the church. And herewith I end this quotation from my booklet, Sociology. Well, with this discussion, then we come to the end of the course. We have looked then at, by way of introduction, to views of human freedom that are so basic that that history is understood as the emergence of freedom. We have seen within humanistic context that human freedom has in some way been invested with a divine quality, and so that something imminent then has been taken as the source or the paradigm of freedom. We have seen then that consequent, that resulting fate of freedom, that freedom has tended to turn into its opposite. We looked at this history and the history of humanistic philosophy when it was thought that freedom could be gained by well-founded knowledge. We saw the reaction of this in the romantic and idealistic movements, and we have seen also the modifications within this, again, where there was a fate of freedom, and so that in very recent times, freedom has been thought of in situation. Well, from a Christian point of view, there is some truth to the fact, as we have seen, that freedom is understood in situation. Not in situation as understood from the standpoint of an existentialism or a Marxism, but situation understood from a biblical, a Christian world and life view, so that freedom is understood in relationship to the sovereignty of God. It is understood in the light of the expression of God's sovereignty in his will, that then expressed in the law or the order which God has sustained. So that freedom is, from a human point of view, then is understood then in subjection, that man is subject then to this law, this order of God. Freedom, if understood in a scriptural, in a Christian way, is never unlimited freedom. It is always freedom in context, but freedom in the context of the order that God has given. It is limited. But in this limitation, there is no limitation in the sense of that which is destructive to freedom. But this limitation, this order, is that which gives freedom even its possibility. It is that which founds, which orders, which opens up freedom for man as he is created by God.